On this episode, we discuss Freaky
Friday?
Kind of.
Okay.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin. And Stuart Wellington, who do we have with us today?
Oh man, this is such a treat. We have a star of the small screen, a star of the big screen, a producer, and a bad movie expert, self-professed, Barbara Crampton.
There you go. Woohoo! Thanks, guys. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thank you. Longtime listeners of the show will know we're a very big fan of your work.
Yeah, So, Stuart, you did a presentation of Stuart Gordon's Castle Freak in Yonkers. You hosted that. With the freak himself in attendance, and I
Jonathan Fuller
years ago. Dan, yeah, I don't want our listeners to think that Stuart's breaking lockdown. This was not like the other.
No.
This was a while ago.
I've been hearing about your love for your thoughts about Castle Freak for a long time. Maybe love too strong a word. I don't know.
Yeah. No, he talks about it a lot,
and I'm easy with my affections.
I was just trying to get to the fact that also in the Brooklyn. Alamo, I introduced a screening of From Beyond. So two out of the three of us have introduced Barbara Crampton screenings, which only leads me to ask, Elliot, what's your problem?
I'll get to it, Dan. As you know, I only screen movies that are at least 70 to 100 years old. So I'm just waiting for the statute of limitations to run out, and then I'll show Reanimator, or maybe I'll show From Beyond 2, a movie that spoke to me very deeply when I was having a medical problem one time, and I was watching From Beyond for the first time, and I was like, "This movie really gets me right now." So that was a movie that really helped me through a difficult weekend.
Well, how did it help you?
It was my first time. This is probably getting too personal. It was my first time dealing with a kidney stone, and it was just a very painful experience. And watching From Beyond and seeing the characters in it dealing with kind of like their reality and their bodies being warped, it really made it was like, okay, this movie is expressing kind of like what I'm feeling right now in a way that makes me feel less alone, since at the time I was very alone because my wife was out of town. So it was just companionship I needed at the moment, you know.
Yeah, misery loves company. So you were, you know, watching Jeffrey Combs morph into all this different creature from the beyond, and it helped you.
Yeah, very much. There's a moment where I think he bites another person's eyeball out, and I was like, yeah, that's what it feels like right now.
That
like,
was Stuart Gordon's wife.
Oh, yeah.
Really? Yeah. Carolyn Gordon.
That's kind of the opposite, Elliot, of the time I broke my arm in a car accident. And my mother went to the grocery store, which is where we rented videos from when I was a child, and she rented me the movie Body Parts, starring Jeff Fahey, which is about a guy who's in a horrible car accident, and he gets a replacement limb from a serial killer that makes him a serial killer or something. So that did not work that way. So when Jeff Fahey comes on the show, I'll let him down.
I mean, but your mom gets you. I mean, that's what that story tells me, is your mom really knows what you're into.
100%.
Did you guys like bad horror movies growing up? Or horror movies in general?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like...
Or is that something that happened to you later?
No, I mean, I like being scared. And I guess the bad horror movie love came from the constantly, like, each weekend going to the video store, like searching for the next great like scare, and often being let down because I thought the box cover looked great, and then by the time I got it home, I'm like, this is nothing like the painting on the cover.
Now, this kind of leads me into a question I wanted to ask you, Barbara, which is, I mean, you chose Freaky. You're like, oh, let's watch this. I wanted to know whether you were a horror fan before you appeared in movies, or whether you sort of were like ground down over the years and and grew to love them?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, I picked Freaky because it was coming out, and I knew I was going to talk to you guys, and I wanted to watch it. I was like, let's watch Freaky, because that's the next movie I want to watch. Yeah. But, you know, I didn't plan to be a horror movie actress. I just wanted to be an actor from the time I was about 11. And I just happened to be in Reanimator, and Stuart took me on this journey. I wouldn't have a career in horror movies without him. And I, you know, it's funny because I didn't grow up seeking out horror genre movies or television shows, but I, when I was younger, I would watch The Outer Limits with my dad and Night Gallery and shows like that. And when I was younger, I don't know how old I would have been, you know, somewhere in sixth or seventh grade, I guess, I watched Dark Shadows. I loved Dark Shadows. Yeah. That was my favorite show. And I would race home from school on my bicycle. We got out at like 10 to 3, and at 3 o'clock the show started. And I just couldn't get enough of that show. I had nightmares every night about it, but I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop watching it. Yeah, and my mother didn't want me to watch it anymore. And I said, I have to watch it, man. Mom, I got to watch this show.
I don't like you calling me man anymore.
Listen, Mom, man.
Man. And so maybe it was going to happen to me. I don't know. I just hear all these stories about these people that grow up and they know so much about horror movies and they sought them out from when they were kids. Their parents watched them and they would get up from their beds and peek over the couch while their parents were watching a movie. That I just, you know, didn't really have, it wasn't that impressed upon me when I was younger. I just, the things that I watched the most were probably The Million Dollar Movie, which played on WPIX Channel 11 in New York every day. Also at like 4 o'clock that came on. So I'd watch Barnabas Collins, and then, you know, I'd watch Miriam Hopkins or Joan, you know, Bennett or something in a movie. And I don't know. I just, you know, I think careers are like that. I don't think too many people I know start out thinking, oh, I'm going to do this in my life, and this is where I'm going, and then that's where they end up. It's usually, and I find that way in working in features and television shows, like the things that people call me up for and they say, I want to hire you for this. I'm like, really? Okay, I'll do that. And then, you know, so life is what happens to you when you're making other plans. It's the kind of, I mean, it's a cliche, but it's true. But I feel like since I came back, you know, I took a break from acting for a long time. I got married, and I actually wasn't getting a lot of roles in my mid-30s to late-30s, and I met my husband, and he said, well, I'm being transferred with my job, so can we move up to San Francisco? And I said, you know, I guess so, because nobody wants me anymore. Nobody's calling me. I don't know what to do. And I really was just an actor for hire, and I wasn't getting any calls. So I stopped working, and I just raised my family, and then I got a call out of the blue to be in Your Next, and that movie blew up.
Yeah.
So when I went to the Toronto Film Festival for that movie and I saw all the executives, because we hadn't sold it yet, out, you know, in the lobby on their phones, calling their higher up saying, you know, we got to buy this movie. And then the next day we had 5 offers from really big companies. I thought, wow, motherhood's really hard and acting's really fun.
That's the lesson.
Yeah. So I said to my agent at the time, who thankfully hadn't lost my number, and I hadn't spoken to him in 6 years, you know, since before Your Next, I said, I think I want to kind of come back to this. I want to come back to acting and do this again. And it was really only at that time in my career, when I took that long break and I came back, that I realized, oh, these are my people. This is my home. This is actually what I do. I didn't realize it. I mean, I went to a few horror conventions, you know, my early, you know, in the latter part of my early life. And it didn't really dawn on me until You're Next. And then I said, okay, my kids are going to grow up at some point. I'm going to need something to do. So why don't I just try to go back into acting? And then I decided that, you know, through some other fluky things that happened, that maybe I would try to produce. But, you know, those kinds of things weren't available to a lot of young actors when we were growing up. But again, when I worked on Your Next, I was working with Joe Swanberg and Amy Simetz and Ty West. And, you know, they were acting in this movie, but they were also writers and producers themselves. And I went, oh, this is what the people do now? This is what they do? How come I didn't do that? How come I didn't do that? Well, everybody stayed in their lane at that point, you know, in my career. That, you know, I was an actor. That's all I did. And you didn't have too many hyphenated people back then. And now we have hyphenates everywhere. Yeah. I said, I'm going to become a hyphenate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I'm. So I guess here I am now. And, and you know, who's going to work with me in comedy? Or even though I think I'm funny. I don't think so. So if I want to work in this business, you know, why don't I work where I'm a part of a club that, you know, we all get one another. So I might as well continue on with horror.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
That's getting into actually something I wanted to ask you about. I don't want to go too far down. We're already going so far down this road, but I just,
let's keep going, Dan. This is a good road. What's wrong with
it? We're all at home.
No, it's true.
Yeah, come on, man. We make the rules. Yeah, but we don't have a boss. Like, no one's going to yell at us and be like, Dan, that wasn't what you were supposed to do.
That just confirms an impression that I had that, like, you know, that you had taken this break, and then, like, people like Adam Wingard, like, maybe they're the people who grew up being fans of those earlier films and sort of, like, now wanted you to be part of what they were doing, you know, like, and
I think that's absolutely true. I think that's absolutely, and they could have called any number of women that are my contemporaries, you know, Felissa Rose or Caroline Williams or Kelly Maroney or Amanda Wiss or Heather Langenkamp. I'm friends with all of those ladies. They all want to work, by the way. So if anybody's listening to this podcast, you should, you know, think about them as well. And I think I just got lucky. Well, actually, it was at an Alamo Drafthouse screening in Texas of Reanimator, and Stuart Gordon was there, and so was Jeffrey, and Simon Barrett, the writer of Your Next, talked to Stuart and said, you know, we have this horror movie coming up, and I don't know, we kind of like to reach out to Barbara Crampton to play the mom in it. What do you think? And Stuart said, oh, no, she's retired. She's not working anymore. And that was kind of true. But for some reason, Simon didn't listen to him and thought, you know what? I want to hire Barbara Crampton. So they offered me the role. Keith Calder and Jessica Wu and Adam and Simon, they just offered it to me without talking to me. So really, it really was a fluky situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said to my agent when he called me, I said, well, don't they want to talk to me, or, you know, don't they want to see what I look like now? I mean, I wasn't on social media at the time. And they said, and he said, no, they just want to hire you. Do you want the job? It starts in 10 days. And I read the script and I thought, oh, it's a cute little script. This is nice. I didn't know any of these people. Yeah. And I did it for a fluke. I did that for a fluke. It was all luck. It really was.
I feel like
I know that those guys were working hard in their craft. I mean, they actually imagined this movie because I think they had gone to another TIFF screening of a James Wan film. I don't know whether it was what was happening at the time, Insidious or The Conjuring. It was probably Insidious, and they thought, wow, this movie's fantastic, and they wanted to get a little more commercial with their work, because they've been working in the trenches of independent cinema, horror cinema for so long. They all banded together after meeting each other at film festivals and said, what can we make? What can we put together to, you know, do as well as James Wan is doing right now? And that's the script for Your Next.
That's great. Yeah. I feel like going back to what you were saying earlier, but like, I feel like everything that's been really exciting and every opportunity that's really worked out well for me has kind of just popped up, and I had to make the decision, okay, I'll just do this thing. Like, I'll do it on a lark. And those are always the things that seem to work out best, even if it's like a little bit outside my wheelhouse or a little bit scary.
Yeah. And I think you just have to be, you know, I think you have to be ready for it is what I was going to say, but you know, you have to keep at it. is another thing that I would say to other people that are in the business that are trying to do whatever you're doing. You guys, you know, work in comedy and people work in horror and whatever. You know, your career, a lot of people switch careers these days and do different things, but if you're in the movie business, it's a very long uphill and downhill career, television business too, right? Uh-huh. And you have to just hang in there for those times that nothing's happening and keep trying to generate things and keep making stuff on your own and keep trying. And then, you know, things will pop up and you can't give up hope. It's a long, you know, your career is a long game. I mean, I've been doing this for 35 years, more than that, really. And I thought I was done when I was 38, 39. I thought, oh, that's it for me. I had Reanimator, I had From Beyond. I did a lot of soap opera work. Okay, I had a good enough career. That's fine. I'm married now. I'm just going to go off into the sunset. And then I had another opportunity and it made me realize, you know, that it's a long game and you have to hang in there. And even Reanimator was, you know, was kind of a hit when it came out, but it wasn't a blockbuster. It wasn't, It developed its cult status over time. So there's a lot of things that people do now that they think, oh, I didn't really hit a big splash with that. But those things have to develop over time. And now we have so much more product out there. It does really take time for things to germinate and, you know, give rise to something that people think is brilliant. Look at The Thing when it came out. Nobody thought The Thing was that many great shakes of a film, and now people love that movie.
I think Roger Ebert even trashed it in his initial review.
Yeah, he gave it like
Thing.
2.5 stars or something. It was crazy. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad I think that pep talk was something that Dan really needed right now, to be honest.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So on the subject of the film business and hanging in there, let's talk a little bit about a movie called Freaky, released in 2020.
Tell me how it relates to hanging in there. I can think of a way, but I want you to tell me.
Well, oh man. I can't, Elliot.
Well, sometimes when your body gets switched with the serial killers, you just got to keep trying. You can't give up the first time.
So just to clarify for listeners, this is Freaky. This was released in 2020. I think it's in theaters, depending on where you live. And otherwise, it's on VOD. So I think it's on VOD worldwide, probably.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
And I do want to say that this is like slightly newer than we usually do. So as always, there's going to be a lot of spoilers. So just if you want to see Freaky, go out and do that first.
I mean, I personally, not to jump to the end, I would recommend to pause this podcast, go watch that movie, then come back. But, you know, that's me. So let's talk a little bit about Freaky. Now, this is a Blumhouse Pictures production. Movie opens. We have a bunch of teens hanging out outside of a mansion. They're talking about a local killer, the Blissfield Butcher. This is like almost like a legendary figure that's also kind of undefined. They think he might be just a myth that the parents tell the kids so they don't party too much on homecoming weekend. Already it kind of sets the tone for like a almost like a Scream or a Happy Death Day, like horror movie with comedy elements, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a note for parents out there. You can use the story of a killer to scare your kids into doing things, but it loses power over time. So when I first started telling my older son, Sammy, that if he didn't clean his room, then the messy madman was going to come and murder him, he was frightened. But now that I use it for everything, I'm like, Sammy, can you please close the door when he stepped outside? Or the messy murderer is going to come. He's like, yeah, I know. Or like, Sammy, can you, like, you got to put your shoes on in case you have to run from the messy murderer. He's like, yeah. So it really, you got to use it sparingly, parents. That's what I'll tell you.
I also, just because Stuart mentioned Happy Death Day, just to clarify, this is the director of that movie, and Happy Death Day to you.
Okay.
Oh, Happy Death Day to you too, Dan. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So, and it's kind of like a Freaky Friday meets like Friday the 13th too. You know, there's a lot of, it's kind of a, it feels like a slasher to me in a way as well.
Yeah.
Well, funny thing about this guy is like he's making a cottage industry of just like putting a couple of genres together, like Happy Death Day is like a slasher plus a time loop, and now this is a slasher plus Freaky Friday body switch type.
If I'm ever gonna get to see that vampire submarine movie that I've always wanted to see, this is the guy to do it.
Right. Oh my god. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, he's charming, isn't he? He's his you know, in all of his films, there's a certain charm. And it's, you know, I think comedy is actually hard to do with horror movies and do it well. I've been the product of a few of them. And sometimes they turn out good and sometimes they really don't. They fall flat. But I think he gets it. I think he knows how to marry those two genres together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's tough to say, like, and it feels like, we'll get into it, but we're introduced to this killer. He dispatches these teens in fairly grisly ways. The killer steals a ceremonial mask off the wall. This is the Blissfield Butcher character played by Vince Vaughn. And not played, I was 100% expecting Vince Vaughn to be the, like, quip-heavy murderer character, like a Freddy Krueger meets Jason, but he's not, and
I want to mention, this is now the second years removed, but this is the second Flophouse movie now where someone has been killed by having a wine bottle shoved in their mouth until it goes into the throat. And seeing
Sorority Row.
And I was like, oh, this, like, it felt like seeing an old friend again, like, seeing this particular kill. But Dan,
I will say that, I mean, you know, spoiler alert for Final Judgments. I enjoyed the movie quite a bit, but there are a few things that I took some issue with, and I think that, like, it's nice to see this, like, very traditional Jason style killer on the one hand, but when you combine it with this Freaky Friday thing, like, part of the fun of that is seeing the personality switch, and so Vince Vaughn gets a lot of personality to play. But the lead, our female lead, gets a lot less, I think.
Catherine Newton.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that's a good juxtaposition for her character as being this young kind of, she's billed as sort of a miss, like an outcast, but she's, she's a bubbly teen. And so... Uh-huh. And to juxtapose that with the Jason, type of character that's very stoic, that doesn't say anything, that's really scary, that, stares at people and moves really heavy and, with menace, I think she did a great job with that. And what else would they have given her if they gave Vince Vaughn this really, out there kind of personality, that kind of a thing? What are they going to give her? So I think what they gave her was a good, differentiation.
Yeah. I mean, I think
she does a great job with it.
Very good job with what was given. I don't know. Like, I guess.
But I understand what you're saying.
A little more.
She didn't have a lot. She didn't have as much to do. It was a Vince Vaughn movie in a way.
Yeah. And Vince Vaughn, this is jumping ahead, but when they switch personalities, he's like, he's got a much bigger personality than she had when she was playing the same character. So it was there were times where I was like, Vince, come on, Vince. But
he was camping it up a little bit, but
when the killer is in Millie's body, he also is much better at makeup than she is. And that threw me slightly.
I was like, Vince Vaughn
wasn't wearing any makeup before. Yeah. But,
it was not explained, but he had a much better sense of style than she did.
With that red jacket and the red lipstick. Oh, yeah. She looked good.
So the killer, after dispatching the teens, steals a ceremonial dagger named Ladola. And then we are introduced to
Is just in someone's house.
Yep, it's just
whatever.
A rich person's house.
He collects artifacts. It's in the classic tradition of the wealthy person's cabinet of curiosities, the forerunner to the modern museum, Dan. Like, let's buy it.
I'm just mentioning it. I kind of love it. I love in these movies when they just, like, hand wave it away, where they're just like, oh, this artifact was just here. It's fine.
He went to a charity auction for his kid's private school.
Uh-huh. And Pier 1 imports.
Yeah, or Pier 1 imports. Or World Market or something. And he got into a bidding war with another dad, and he didn't even know what he was bidding on. And they were like, you got this ceremonial Aztec dagger. And he's like, great, okay. I guess I have this now. He thought it was a signed Mark McGuire ball that he was bidding on, but so that's my backstory for why that's in his house.
Great, perfect.
So we're introduced to Millie, who is our hero, who we've already talked about, played by Catherine Newton. She's a little bit of a pushover. She's a little meek. She's got a mother with a drinking problem. She's got a sister named Charlene, which is my wife's name. Charlene was very excited to see another Charlene represented on screen.
Now, Stuart, you're probably wondering. So, Katie Finneran, who plays the mother in Freaky, you're probably wondering, Elliot, did you see her Tony Award-winning performance in Noises Off on Broadway?
Yes, I did, in
2002. So you were probably wondering that. I'll just get that out of the way. Yes, I did.
Barbara, I want to make it clear that this is a running theme of the show, which is Elliot not really name dropping, because it's not like he hangs out with these people, just, you know, mentioning that he saw people in plays.
Yeah, so
he knows things. Elliot knows things.
Oh yeah, I know.
There's one thing he does. It's
if someone was performing in a Broadway show between probably 1995 and 2014 or so, then there's a good chance I saw them in it. And so I saw that production, and audience, just go to your bingo card where it says Noises Off and put on your Elliot's theater going bingo card. Put one on, Noises Off. Stuart, continue.
So we're introduced to this character, Millie. She goes to school. Everybody kind of bullies her. We find out that her father is dead, and that you would think that would make people bully her less. That is not the case. Mm. Everybody bullies her, including the shop teacher played by Alan Ruck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Favorite.
So good. I hated him in the movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're supposed to not like him. He was mean.
I was so torn because, to me, anytime I see Alan Ruck in something, he's the hero of the story, no matter who he's playing or what he's doing. And for him to be so mean in this, I was like, oh, Alan, it's really hard for me to like you, but I still do. But, you know.
I think that was the most engaged Audrey was watching. I mean, she enjoyed it largely, but, like, the most engaged was yelling for him to die.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how she acts when she sees him in Succession as well, right?
Yeah.
And on Spin City.
Oh, weird. Yeah. I guess that makes sense. Actually, I feel like he's done a pretty good late career, like, slime ball arc. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe. Oh, yeah. I mean, he's but every character has a little touch of Cameron, so you can't totally hate them. Still, the whiny rich kid who's dead doesn't like him, you know. Which is Succession, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe Succession is about Cameron's family. Does Ferris Bueller ever show up in Succession, Stuart? I haven't watched it.
I think he shows up in the second season. I don't remember it very well.
Okay.
So in our movie, Millie is stuck at school after the big game. We find out that she is she's the mascot. So she's wearing this comically oversized costume of a beaver.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah, it's great. It also, it's like, this is the perfect prop for a character who's going to have to run away from a killer in a moment.
I don't want to harp on any actors' looks, but it's one of those movies where everyone acts as if she's hideous early on when she's clearly like a very
pretty
person.
She doesn't look like somebody who would be bullied. I watched it with my husband last night, and he said the same thing. But then I reminded him of, you know, my kids' experiences in school.
Yeah.
I have a senior in high school, and then I have a kid who's in college. And, you know, kids are mean at that age. They're mean to everybody.
Yeah.
A lot of it, Dan, is how you carry yourself. When I was young, I got bullied a lot, but now I'm a successful underwear model, and you wouldn't guess from that you wouldn't guess it from that I was bullied so much, but it happens, you know.
Yeah, and sometimes, Dan, people bully people because they're intimidated by them. It's happened to me all the time.
Is that why you guys are constantly bullying me?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I'm an agent to a popular underwear model, Elliot Kalin.
Keep those jobs coming, Stu. The one opportunity I feel like they missed with this mascot costume is not having the killer in Millie's body using the mascot costume.
Oh, yeah, that would have been
kill
good.
Someone.
Yeah. But I guess they're saving it for Freaky too.
Yeah. So it's great. So her mother drinks too much and passes out and fails to pick her up from the game. She's left at school alone. All the lights go out, except, of course, we see the butcher is standing in the parking lot. He chases her. Eventually, he catches her. He stabs her with the ceremonial Ladola dagger that he's stolen, which makes kind of a weird, spooky sound. And at this point, there's a little special effect visual where they're transported to the top of an Aztec temple. So we know that there's something definitely supernatural going on.
Neither of them seem to notice that they've been transported to a temple and there's a bunch of weird blue lightning going on. Like, until the switcheroo happens at midnight, it seems like the two of them don't seem to notice it. You know, like, they're they're living their normal lives, you know, stalking and slashing people and getting stalked and slashed.
It's possible that the football field was built on an Aztec temple, and this is one of those kind of David McCauley type books where they show you cross sections of things.
I see.
Yeah.
But I really loved that effect. I was not expecting it, and I thought it was really cool, the fact that they didn't draw too much attention to it and it just kind of happened, and then it was a neat thing.
And it's one of those effects that made me kind of miss, well, like many things, it made me miss seeing a movie in a movie theater. Like, I feel like it would have looked great on the big screen. So he stabs Millie, and then he gets a matching cut on his own shoulder. We know something is up, and then he is scared off when Millie's sister, Charlene, the police officer, arrives and starts shooting at him. We think everything is fine. She goes to the police. She makes a report. They, when the killer was scared off, he left the dagger behind, Ladola. I'm going to say that as many times as possible.
Okay.
It's all about branding, guys. And then they go.
Wait,
to
so that's your brand now, or?
No, I mean, when I found out that we were doing this movie, I reached out to the manufacturers of Ladola brand daggers.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
And they said if I mention it,
slicing tomatoes,
they'll give you some money to plug them.
You know, times are tough here in this economy. So I figure if I can make a little bit of Ladola dollars or La dollars,
Stu. I knew you had to say it, Stu. But now, for the record, I'm now looking up what Ladola means, and I'm finding some contradictory things. Apparently, in Spanish, according to one website, it does mean leapfrog. So I don't know. But it also in Slavic mythology, apparently Dola are protective spirits that embody human fate, and in Sanskrit it seems to mean swinging or oscillating. So I don't know if any of those really apply, but if anyone knows the appropriate meaning of the word Dola, write in to the Flophouse, care of Dan's apartment, 123 America Street, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So they go. Millie goes to sleep. We get some special effects, and then when she wakes up, that's right, we've had a body switch, and the screen announces in with a pretty funny chyron that it is Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
So it is indeed a Freaky Friday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and they did a good job with that reveal of the two characters, because that's when we first see them, you know, switching bodies and how. The character of Millie woke up and, you know, she was now the butcher and looking around her room and seeing all the girly things and, you know, feeling her body. And then, you know, her mom walks in and just the way she carried herself all changed. And I thought the actress did a very good job with that. And and then Vince Vaughn was in his lair with all his weird, you know, and the lair was pretty cool. The production design. You know, it's like these open windows and a dirty old bloody mattress on the ground and all these weird things hanging, you know, from the ceiling. It looked like, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre living room or something.
I was just going to, like, I loved how, like, it was like a joke in and of itself that they, like, pushed the serial killer lair all the way, you know, like she wakes up and like there's dead animals hanging from the ceiling and such.
Yeah, bones and things and stuff hanging around. Yeah, it was
like this serial killer has spent more time on interior design than I ever have in my normal apartment.
Well, you got to make a space your own, and you got to make it so that you're comfortable in it. And clearly, he has very specific comfort needs, and it takes a lot of work. I was reading about the factory, Andy Warhol's building, and just about how they like painted the inside of it and covered it with foil. So it was all silver, shining silver everywhere in the interior of the building. And I was like, I would find that distracting, but apparently to someone that was the right workplace. So you can't, you know, it's like him with his lair. You can't judge. Yeah.
Yeah. As long as the end result is great, you know, you can't really fault it.
And I mean, the Blissfield Butcher, he's had a long career in killing people in Blissfield. You got it. The guy's still going strong. You got to give it to him. He knows what works.
I feel like there's got to be a bunch of old mills in this town for him to survive this long. It doesn't matter. It's fine.
Well, but it's like how in Gotham City, there's that whole section of the city that's just abandoned amusement parks that bad guys use.
We talked about Catherine Newton, who plays Millie, but in this case, she plays the Butcher. As like the butcher realizes that there's been a swap. And I feel like for an actress, like a young actress, this is probably got to be really fun to get to play this like straightforward and evil of a character.
Yeah.
I feel like that kind of role doesn't come around a lot.
She's this little girl, you know, and she's this cute young thing, and she's playing this, you know, really, as you say, evil, sort of dark character who, you know, she doesn't speak a lot in the second half of the movie. It's mostly with her facial features and how she's, you know, peering at people and looking at them and being very menacing. And, you know, I wonder how much of that really came from her, or, you know, did the director work with her, or, you know, how did that happen with both of them? Because I thought she did a great job with it. Yeah. It was believable to me.
Yeah. And I also liked how, you know, like Vince Vaughn is a giant man. And I liked how once the switch happened, the killer in this much smaller body sort of had to, like, kept sort of trying to fight like he was still Vince Vaughn, but then, like, had to figure out a better way of murdering people.
Well, the scene where she's trying to, him and her body is trying to break down a door, and it's like, in Vince Vaughn's body, you could probably just smash a door down, but not when you're in Catherine Newton's body. Like, they had some funny stuff with that.
Yeah, and then Vince Vaughn was, like, running around with his hands out and, you know, very girly. You know, he kind of really worked into that a lot, just being more feminine and in his mannerisms and in his speaking voice and everything. You know, it was charming.
Yeah, and I feel, well, I don't know. Like, at least I was a little nervous that it was going to get over the top or become, like, offensive, and I didn't feel like it at any point. Like, it felt pretty... Like it disappeared. Like you believed it, at least for me.
Well, there's a scene later, and I won't talk about it too much until we get to it, where they kind of take the fact that it's a girl in Vince Vaughn's body to its logical conclusion, and it was a scene that like really worked for me when it maybe shouldn't have in the way. Like it's a scene I didn't think they'd be able to pull off, and that they did, and we'll talk about that scene later.
So from now on, I'm just going to clarify. I'm going to refer to the butcher, even though the butcher is in Millie's body. I will refer to that character as the butcher, and now Millie is in the butcher's body. That is now Millie. Just to be clear.
Yeah.
Okay. So they both end up going. You know, they try to get used to their new bodies. They both end up going to school. Millie realizes that she realizes her predicament. And that she also realizes that there's a sketch out for the butcher. So people are looking for her. She can't just wander around. Also, she stinks. So
she wants to take a shower.
Yeah, of course. So they both end up going to school. The butcher's using this as an opportunity, I'm guessing, to show off some cool outfits and to stalk some new victims. We're introduced to a queen bee character at the high school named Ryler. Now, Elliot, you're kind of an expert on this sort of thing. What medieval profession is a Ryler?
So a Ryler, as you've mentioned, a lot of trendy names now, they are medieval occupations.
Fletcher.
A cooper, of course, a Fletcher, a piper. A Ryler, I assume, is someone who would kind of rile up a bear before a bear baiting match, like they do, like a rodeo clown, like they just run out and go, hey, 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 bear, hey, bear, hey, bear. Either that or
More of a psychological bothering though,
like. Yeah, exactly. Hey, bear, what's over your shoulder? Nothing, you fell for it again. Either that or maybe someone who made rye bread. That's another possibility. Rye bread, I guess. Yeah, in probably like medieval Germanic or Prussian states. You know, that's where you would find that. So those are my two thoughts on what that would be. Yeah.
So the Ryler character gets stuffed in a freezing machine that's in the locker room. I'm guessing it's some kind of an athletic thing.
It's cryotherapy, but I do not think that there's any cryotherapy machine. Number one, that's a very expensive piece of equipment for this high school to have. And number two, I don't think there's one that goes to like liquid nitrogen levels of cooling so that someone
in a high
shattered.
School.
In the movie where a serial killer and a teenager switch bodies. This was the part where I was like, hold on a second.
I don't believe this.
Yeah, it's a futuristic cryo booth, not in the girls' locker room. So it's not even accessible to most of the school. Well, not most, it's not accessible to half the student body. It seemed like a strange thing. And at first, I was like, is it a like a sauna? No, it says cryo on it, and she freezes to the point that she shatters. So I don't know. It might be like when a school gets a 3D printer, and it's just to show off to the parents to be like, look at what we got. We never use it, but we have it.
Honestly, I had to look on Wikipedia to figure out why the hell there was this flash freezing human device.
Do they explain it in the novelization of Freaky, Dan? Do you know?
By Alan Dean Foster,
probably. We both guessed who the writer probably is. Alan Dean Foster.
Okay, so Ryler gets killed. Millie.
Well, we should talk about
Millie.
Yeah, who are Millie's two friends that she talks to?
Yeah.
We have Josh and Nyla, right?
Josh and Nyla, yeah. And they're her two friends, and they're the only ones who kind of like give her any support otherwise, since most of student body sees her as a Carrie-esque outcast.
Yeah,
you know?
A target for bullying. So Millie stalks them, finds them, and then manages to convince them of the situation in a pretty fun action sequence. It's like it starts as a chase as Nyla and Josh run away from Millie, thinking that Millie's the butcher with good reason. And then they end up getting in a big fight in the school, the luckily unoccupied school cafeteria kitchen. And it's pretty fun. Like they get some good, like it's, you know, like Vince Vaughn.
Pots and pans and things. Yeah.
Yeah. Vince Vaughn does a good job of making it seem like Millie is getting used to this new body, this like giant, overly strong body.
Yeah. Cause...
And they're all just hitting each other with ladles and stuff. Like there's something kind of Laurel and Hardy about it at a certain point.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the Vince Vaughn body, like she doesn't want to hurt her friends, but they are hitting her with ladles, and she has this giant Hulk who I've seen tear apart a car in Brawl on whatever it's called.
Cellblock 99. Yeah. Yep.
She convinces them that she is Millie in the butcher's body by having a callback to a cheer that they did, or it was a handshake that they did in the beginning of the film. They did this weird handshake. So she does the hand. Who would know that handshake unless I was Millie? And then, and then they go, holy crap. Oh my God, it's you. You know, and then she says some other things that nobody would know except for them. And then they believe her.
Yeah, they answer all those deep-seated questions that teenagers only share with their besties.
Now,
and I think this worked. I feel like the dynamic between the three of them was fun the whole time.
Stuart, Elliot, what would you ask me to make it clear that I was
in the body of a murderer?
I'd say, how are you doing today? And you go, well, and I'd be like, that's Dan. Oh my God, what happened to him? Why is he in this killer's body? Stuart, what would you ask Dan?
I would, let me see. I would, I'm like, how can I make a joke that is like a joke
mean.
And funny and not mean?
How do I ask him something that actually doesn't reveal in front of our guests something that he probably doesn't want to be public knowledge in front of anybody?
True. I would probably ask you to bake me something from your encyclopedia of bread. Mm-hmm. And if you couldn't do it on command, I would know you're a serial killer.
I love the idea of a serial killer in Dan's body who's like thinks he can bluff you by fussing with dough and things in the oven.
And I'm like, well, I turn the oven light on. I get down on my haunches and like, it's gonna have a soggy bottom. I don't know. Real Dan wouldn't do this.
It's just like the Great British Bake Off at a certain point.
Basically,
and the killer's like, I hope they don't notice that it kind of fell apart at the end. And you'd be like, it kind of falls apart at the end.
And
go,
Paul
Hollywood
comes out and like sort of glares, and you think, oh no, he thinks you are the killer, but then he shakes your hand and realizes.
So that's been a deep dive into the Great British Baking Show.
Yeah.
So they realize that the heart of their problem is this magical dagger, Ladola. And they look it up on the internet and they...
No, they look it up on the internet and then there's an inscription on it in Spanish. So they take it to the Spanish teacher at the school, who is kind of like the Spanish teacher at this high school is basically the non English speaking native character you see in a lot of horror movies, who like is extremely superstitious and extremely knowledgeable about this mystic artifact.
Uh-huh.
And this is another thing. She literally says Madre de Dios when she's looking at it, and I was like, come on.
And you know what was funny about that too? She was the Spanish teacher, and she's talking to the kid in Spanish. She's talking to Josh, played by Misha. What's his last name?
Osherovich.
Osherovich, yeah. And she's speaking to him in Spanish. She's like, I don't know what you're saying. No comprende per favor. She's like, you've been taking my class for 4 years. He goes, yeah, I can't speak a word of it. And that is so my kid's experience in high school. Like, that happened in this movie because I have two like high schoolers that I went, oh my God, that is exactly what's happening, because my daughter's taking Spanish. She's in the next room for 4 years. She can't speak a word of it. Because, you know, I don't know why, but we're just not good with languages here unless, you know, you're actually speaking it every day, us Americans.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of like that with French when I tried to take French in school, because I thought, like, the cool kids were all taking French, and then by the time I started, I'm like, I'm not interested in this. I can't, you know, it's not fun to speak.
I had 4 years. None of it stuck. So
Well, unless you're using it all the time, you know. Yeah. I made a couple movies in Italy. And I actually had to work with the Italians, and they didn't speak English. So I learned more over there, you know, working with them for 6 weeks than I did in the night classes I took at UCLA before I went over to do the movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When it's a life or death situation in that you're like, where's the bathroom or where is this thing that I need? Then like you learn pretty quickly, I think. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. So
they figure out, so the Spanish teacher explains the stakes, and the stakes are, if they don't stab each other again, the change is going to be permanent. If they don't stab each other again by midnight, the change is going to be permanent, right? So right around now, the butcher attacks the shop teacher, played by Alan Ruck. This is a pretty funny fight sequence. because the butcher keeps overestimating his strength. So, but eventually he manages to overcome, and the logical conclusion of Alan Ruck ending on a table saw is fulfilled. It's great.
Oh my
it's
God. I can't believe how gory this movie was at times.
It was
I was really surprised.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? This is a Blumhouse movie, and they don't really do that much gore.
Yeah, I mean, Happy Death Day did not have this same level of gore.
No, yeah.
It really didn't.
But it was all great. It was all well done, and it was fairly visceral.
I didn't expect to see that much of inside Alan Ruck, and you see a lot more of his insides than you
certainly
expect.
Certainly not outside his book, Inside Alan Ruck.
Yeah. Well, he's talking emotionally there. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh man, he takes you into what he calls Ruck space, his special place that only Alan Ruck knows about. But now you get to join him. Inside Alan Ruck. It's available from Ruckhouse, his self-publishing arm.
Yeah. So the around now, the cops have come to the school. They see Millie and Millie's friends, and we have a chase. They jump into Josh's terrible little car and drive away from the school.
I really related to that car, since my car is falling apart. And constantly finding new ways to not work properly. So seeing that was another moment where you're a person just watching a movie and you're like, this movie is speaking to me, maybe on a level that the filmmakers didn't expect to.
Yeah. Yeah. So of course, Millie's sister, Charlene, of course, my wife's name, Charlene.
please keep reminding us.
she ends up chasing them. They try to lose her in a giant discount store. They stick Millie in a changing room where she has a kind of like a catfish style heart to heart with her mom. It's a scene that goes on for a while where her mom.
That was a cute scene.
Yeah, that's
great.
A good scene, Stu.
Yeah.
But it was funny in that I was like not expecting this kind of long heartfelt conversation between mother and daughter, between a, you know, in a changing room, and the mother doesn't realize that she's talking to her daughter, but it's the conversation their daughter needed to hear. Her mother instead thinks she's talking to a man who
she becomes attracted to in that moment. Yeah, his voice.
Yeah, and as I said, I've been watching a lot of Catfish lately, so I was having some real triggering moments here where I'm like, oh, I don't know, you really shouldn't be going through with this. But luckily, it doesn't get any weirder. They end up, I feel like they end up they run off, or they find out that the butcher has taken some potential victims, including Booker, who is Millie's crush. They take
one nice member of the football team. Everyone else in the football team is a real jerk, except for Booker.
Yeah. I just want to mention too, during the football team sequence, when they were out there in the beginning of the movie, mm-hmm. one of the guys, and I don't remember which guy it was, but he had on his jersey the name Strode.
Oh, Laurie Strode. Mm. Yeah, only for the true horror freaks.
For
the real
Woody Strode
sickos.
From the John Ford Westerns. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, no, they find via Instagram where this dude is, the one that Millie has the crush on.
Booker.
And there's, she's threatening these dudes, the killer is, and goes into this back area where it's like, it's a blacklight miniature golf course haunted house kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, what is this town that they're in that has the cryotherapy and this
cool
ass mini golf place that I would love to go to?
It's definitely a business I've never heard of, but now I really want to go to. Yeah. Like a haunted house mini golf. They did
definitely, like, you know, take some things that they thought, oh, this would be cool. Let's stick this in the movie. You know? But it kind of worked. Like, it didn't. I mean, the cryogenic therapy thing kind of threw me off a little bit, but I went with it. But yeah, and then that other place, the miniature golf place, was like, what is that? But, you know, you just kind of go with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like the cryotherapy bit wasn't even in the script. They were just like, they had one lying around Blumhouse Studios, and they're like, we got to use this thing.
Yeah, this thing's been lying around. Yeah,
we bought it thinking we would use it in four movies. We've used it in two. We got to... Like, it hasn't paid for itself yet.
And I do love this like blacklight mini golf course, because it's kind of like disco bowling or whatever, you know, when they or blacklight bowling. But it also kind of reminded me of the end of The Guest, when they're like walking through the maze. So,
and it struck me what a realistic looking blacklight mini golf course. It wasn't what, like, any time on the TV show Modern Family, they would do like a haunted house. It would be like, well, this is a haunted house from a movie. Like, this is not something a family could put together. Yeah. But here I was like, yeah, I believe this is what a haunted house mini golf course would look like should one exist.
Although that is in concert. That is in contrast to the replacement homecoming dance that the teens seem to be able to throw together with like a DJ and so
and
many
like
decorations. It looks
amazing. That's the opposite of that.
Yeah, but I think teens are more likely to be able to put shit together at the last minute than, say, we are, Dan. I mean, kids are pretty industrious, you know, especially when parties are involved.
And the other thing I want to say about that mini golf course is there's a bunch of things written on the walls. Like, there's one, it's like a Grim Reaper, and says, like, I'll get you at tea time or something like that.
That's right.
I was like, somebody had the fun of thinking up what they were going to write on the wall of the haunted house mini golf course.
So,
of course, a fun day on the set.
Of course, they manage to subdue the butcher, and they manage to convince. Oh, and they also knock out Booker, and they go back to Josh's house, where Josh's mom is supposed to be gone for the weekend. And they convince Booker, Millie's crush, that there was a body swap when Millie recites from memory a love poem that she had written for him. And left in his locker, what, a week ago, 2 weeks ago?
And put in there anonymously, so he wasn't signed. Yeah.
And this is where this starts a ball rolling downhill, which will eventually hit the bottom of the hill, but it becomes a very exciting little plot arc for me.
I want to say, too, though, this points up one of the... I know it's weird to... worry about plot holes in a Freaky Friday slasher movie.
But
I do think that in the movie, it is pretty easy for Millie to convince...
To memorize a poem? Yeah,
no,
tell me about it.
Easy for Millie to convince her friends and her love interest that that she is in the body of this murderer. And... but with Charlene, who is on the police, could like help out greatly. They don't even make an attempt to be like, let's call her on the phone. Let's have him say a few things that, you know, like the special keywords, like with everyone else. You know, it seems like a weird weird problem with the movie.
I would say I thought it was a little refreshing to me that she could convince, because in real life, if someone came to you and said, here's a thing that I know about that nobody else would know except for you and me, you wouldn't reject that out of hand too much. But whenever Shara sees a problem, she just pulls out her gun and yells at it, and maybe that's a situation they just don't think they can get into. You know,
yeah.
It's not until Charlene is literally like disarmed and locked in a jail cell that Millie is like, "Hey, I'm your sister. Okay, I gotta go. Goodbye." So
yeah,
I get it.
So
which raises the question though, Stu, if you were switched with somebody else's body, how would you convince your Charlene that it was you?
Ooh, that's very difficult. I'm in a different body. I would probably start reciting, I don't know, like Lord of the Rings facts. And I wouldn't even have to be that accurate about it, because as soon as I started talking, I would see her eyes glaze over and I would know I got her. So Booker's on the team. They come up with a plan. They need to get the dagger back from the police station, and they need to bring it back and stab the butchers so that they can get that body swap happening. So they go to the police station, of course. Josh is left with the butcher to guard a tied up butcher. They get to the police station, and Nyla sneaks in. She distracts Charlene briefly by saying, "The butcher's outside," which I feel like you're raising the stakes too high. I feel like at that point when you're trying to misdirect somebody, you could go a little bit I feel like you're putting Charlene's, which is my wife's name, Charlene's alert level at like 100% at that point.
The only reason I agree with you is because the butcher actually is outside, but Millie in his body. And yeah. So I would worry that Charlene would run out, see the butcher in the car, and just fire at him and kill her own sister in a tragic, almost Greek, you know, sort of thing. Maybe there was a prophecy about it. I don't know. I'm just spitballing the Greek tragedy version of this story, which I would call, I guess, Freakipus.
Freakipus. Yep.
Freakipus or Oedipus Freaks. Now we get
some more complications. Josh's mom comes home and tries to cut the butcher free, thinking the butcher is Millie. And of course, at this point, the butcher manages to get free and chase them around with a knife before fleeing the house and stealing a police car. And the dagger? Does she get the dagger at this point?
Yeah, he gets the dagger at that point.
There's a lot of action happening.
Yeah, when she goes to the police station, she gets the dagger. Yeah.
While we're at the police station, Millie and Booker are hiding in the back of the car, and they have a really deep conversation.
Oh my god! Yeah.
And this was my wife's favorite scene in the movie. She loved it.
I can't believe it was so
I was not expecting a scene with Vince Vaughn could convince me that he is a teenage girl with a huge crush on a boy. And that both actors are great in this scene.
Yeah.
And he like moves to the back seat of the car to sit next to Millie, and there's even a kiss, and it's so fucking funny.
And it's a scene that it feels like they're doing it real. Like it's a funny scene, but they're not playing it really silly.
Yeah, they play it honestly.
Yeah.
And it's played very sweetly.
Yes. Yeah. And I never got the sense that the joke was like, this is two guys kissing. But the joke was that like they are for that. He sees her in there for that moment and kind of forgets that she's in this body. And really, it's more that he's a hulking brute who smells terrible that snaps him out of it. And it was this scene and the one where she's talking to her mom in the killer's body. It was like, oh, these are scenes that they could have turned into really like kind of like verbal slapsticky type scenes. Yeah. Instead, they played them much more emotionally.
I think they were handled very well. And I think, you know, they deserve a bigger compliment because, you know, it's about the theme that it doesn't matter what you look like. It's really about the inside and who you are as a person. And that's really what matters. And it was handled so gently and delicately and nicely, and a lot of the movie is kind of funny and over the top, but these moments were handled with a lot of care by everyone, and it really worked.
I wanted to say I do not want to suggest that that like people of all different sorts can't have empathy for all different sorts of people, but the lack
no, go ahead.
Of
suggest it. Go ahead.
No,
go
I'm not suggesting it. But the sweetness and the like, just sense of like it does not matter what you look like; it matters who you're inside. The director of this, Christopher Landon, is an out gay man. I think that like a lot of the empathy there comes from that experience. I also discovered his dad is Michael Landon.
Of course, oh, I didn't know wow. that.
I did not know
oh,
that.
Yeah, oh yeah,
that's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's been around the business for a while.
Yeah,
you
know?
Yeah.
So the butcher shows up, grabs the dagger, drives off in a police car. Josh connects up with his friends.
We're hearing that police car now.
Yeah. I can't tell if that's on my side or Dan's side. I'm assuming if it's a police car, it's probably me then.
It's part of Stuart's theater of the mind experience that makes him pull off.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I strap a little speaker to my cat, and the cat runs around the apartment to give the sense of a Doppler effect. Okay, so the butcher is going to the makeshift homecoming dance that has been moved to his horrible old mill that we saw previously, and we complimented its decorations.
Yeah, I guess we missed the montage where all the teens clean up those carcasses hanging from the ceiling.
Just take the montage the montage from Sister Act where they clean up the old church, or
yeah,
Sister
exactly.
Act 2, I guess they do it in. Yeah. Like, just use that one, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe both Sister Acts they do that. Do both Sister Acts have cleanup montages?
This is
the question I would ask you if you came to me in Murderer's
Audrey.
Body.
She's a big Sister Act expert.
Okay.
Both of them.
So our heroes head over to the old mill. We have a showdown. The butcher manages, in the middle of the party, to murder three date rapists. And then a fourth date rapist that attempts to push himself on Josh. We get some more bodies. They manage to capture the butcher. It looks like they have run out of time, that their watches, that it's already midnight, but then there's a callback to a previous moment when we realize that the watch that Millie is carrying is Booker's, and Booker always sets his watch 5 minutes fast, or is it late? I can't remember which.
Five minutes fast.
Yeah.
Yeah, to set it 5 minutes late would not be a huge help.
That actually makes sense.
So it's not midnight yet, and they have time.
Yeah, they have time. Millie stabs the butcher, and they swap bodies, and then the cops shoot the butcher a bunch. And this was the point where I'm like, wait a minute, did they actually switch? Is there another twist? Nope. Luckily, they don't have to wait till midnight. I was worried it was going to be a wait till midnight situation.
Yeah, I got to say, I was very happy, honestly, that there was no like final rug pull in that way, because the older I get, the more when I watch a horror movie, I want it to like end tidily. Like I want I just want everyone to be happy, guys. You know.
I wonder if there was a point with the script where they're like, no, Millie is still stuck in stuck in the butcher's body, but then has to come back. But whatever. So
I feel like that's the kind of thing you can do in a movie with a darker tone than this one.
Yeah.
Like this movie is not going for the not going for that kind of final scare, and I appreciated that too, because it was like, I don't want to imagine this killer living in her body while Millie is murdered, you know, basically.
Yes.
And it was, but there, you know, the 1986 straight to video version of this would probably have that ending.
Yeah. So everything seems okay, and then we have one final scare. The butcher survived his shooting. He comes back after Millie, and then Millie, her mom, and Charlene, which is my wife's name, manage to defeat the butcher and ram a stake through his heart.
I thought that was going to be a dream sequence, though, because when they shot the butcher, he had like four or five bullet holes in him.
Yeah.
And it impacted his shirt. He had that black shirt on, uh-huh. and there were bullet holes in the shirt. And then when he came back, there was no bullet holes in his shirt. And I said to my husband, this is a dream sequence.
Uh-huh.
And thank God it wasn't a dream sequence, because I'm kind of sick of those dream sequences.
Yeah.
and it was real. Like, he came back, and that was a continuity error. Where are those bullet holes?
Mm-hmm.
But I do like you had bought in enough in the movie where you're like, it's got to be a dream sequence. They wouldn't mess this up.
Right. Well, I also think they wanted to give the whole, you know, the heroes of the movie the chance to actually dispatch the killer.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
That was the point of it.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah. And to show like Millie has stepped up because she, you know, she's tough.
Well, that's and to see her family has come together now. Like they're by as many times in horror movies, families that have problems and dysfunction can overcome them by murdering somebody together.
Like that is the overarching.
That's so true. That is true.
The overarching sick joke of the movie is like it is taking that thing from like a body swap movie where like this has improved our lives, where like it really has improved Millie's life that she swapped with this killer for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this movie is really lean, you know, with its story points. It gets right to it. There's not a lot of, you know, extra things there. This is the story. Let's get to it. Let's have some good set pieces. Let's have some cool characters. This is our story. And it has a message. And, you know, people get what they need out of it. And, you know, the heroes overcome.
And I feel like they understand the character beats they need everybody to hit, and they for them like I feel like they hit them all. Like it's a fun time at the movies.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was charming. That's my one word. You know, encapsulation of the whole movie. I thought it was charming.
Yeah. It feels like rather than just trying to get across on the gimmick of it. That they put the work into the tone and into those emotional beats of the characters, and that was really nice.
Yeah, and I think the music helped with that too. The music was very upbeat and very light, you know. And even in the darker moments, it wasn't dark music. I mean, the whole tone is a really difficult thing, and especially since it's comedy and horror, to put that together. I think the tone is, you know, difficult to get, and I think the music really helped with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is the point where normally we would be like, oh, is this a good, bad movie, a bad, bad movie, or a movie you kind of liked? I think we all liked it to a greater or lesser degree. I mean, like, it is very zippy. It is like a candy bar of a movie. You're just going to have fun. I think I do like the Happy Death Day movies a little more because I think they're slightly more inventive, and I really like Jessica Roth as the...
Yeah, she's fantastic as an actress, yeah.
Yeah.
But this is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think it's worth watching. I recommend it.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Yeah.
Elliot, how do you feel? You're not, you don't usually watch a lot of the horror movies.
You don't usually talk a lot. What do you think?
It was exciting to me to see a movie that is new. Since I don't often get the chance to do, I mean, that's I am very saddened about what's happening with the movie theater industry, but, as the father of two small children, I very rarely get to go to the theaters anyway. So it's exciting to me to see a movie that is like, it's like, oh, this is a new movie. Like I haven't already seen all the takes on this, you know, and the backlash to those takes and then the backlash to the first backlash. And then the critical consensus kind of settles in. And then a year later I get to see it. So it's like, oh, I'm seeing a movie that I don't know too much about already. This is great. And the movie was a lot of fun.
Yeah. There was a moment early on, and I may have mentioned this on the show, but there was a moment early on in quarantine when they first started offering up like new release movies for like a $20 rental on demand. And I like jumped at watching The Invisible Man because I was like, I just need to watch a new movie right now.
Well, that was the thing too. So when it came on our screens, we're all like, oh, $20. My husband said that too. We got to pay $20 for this. Yeah, we have to pay $20 because you know, it's a new film. You know, it hasn't gone through the theaters already. It's not $3.99 or $2.99. Yeah. It's $20 bucks. So.
It's the new like model of business at this point.
Well, and someone who writes for television, I both get why people like have sticker shock and sort of get like a little annoyed at it because I'm like, well, if I went to the Alamo, like I'm gonna end up paying like
$40 with your
40
dinner
bucks.
And whatever.
Yeah.
And you gotta pay for a flight to Texas. That's a big cost, right? Yeah.
Well, they have like, the Alamo in New York, right?
Right.
You're paying for that one screen too, like as many people are in the household can watch it at the same time. Like it is not, you know.
Oh, that's I had the same thing. I was like $19.99 to watch a movie at home in a room that's much more comfortable to me than a movie theater, and I don't have to wear shoes, and for free I can eat whatever I want. This is outrageous. And I was like, oh, wait a second. this is a nicer experience in some ways.
It was fun when it went up and I saw, you know, when it went up on Friday and we had the, you know, I saw the price. I'm like, I wonder how long it's going to be before I get a text from Elliot complaining about the price.
Oh, and then I did.
Oh, man.
Well, hello. I'm Renee Colvert.
Hi, I'm Alexis Preston, and we are the hosts of Can I Pet Your Dog?
And we got breaking news, we got an expose, and all the beans have been spilled via an Apple Podcast review that said, this show isn't well-researched. Well, yeah, no duh. Of course it's not. Not since the day we started has it been well-researched. Guessing and anthropomorphizing dogs is what we do.
The Can I Pet Your Dog promise is that we will never do more than 10 seconds of research before telling you excitedly about any dog we see.
I'm going to come at you with top 10 enthusiasm, minimal facts.
We're here for a good time, not an educated time.
So if you love dogs and you don't love research, well, you know what? Come on in to Can I Pet Your Dog podcast every Tuesday on Maximum Fun Network.
Hi, I'm James, host of Minority Corner, which is a
podcast that's all about intersectionality. It's hosted by James with a guest host every week.
Discussing all sorts of wonderful issues, nerdy and political.
Pop culture.
Black queer feminism.
Race, sexuality.
News.
You're going to learn your history, their self-empowerment, and it's told by what feels like your best friend.
Why should someone listen to Minority Corner?
Why not?
Oh my God, free stuff.
There's not free stuff.
The listeners of Minority Corner will enjoy some necessary LOLs, but mainly a look at what's happening in our world through a colorful lens.
People will get the perspective of marginalized communities.
I feel heard. I feel seen.
Like you said, you need to understand how to be more proactive in your community, and this is a great way to get started.
Join us every Friday on Max Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
Minority Corner.
Because together we're the majority.
So Barbara, this was so much fun. Thanks for coming. Now, I know the longtime Flophouse listeners would kill me if I didn't ask, but I need to know, how did you get involved in soap operas?
Oh my gosh! I don't know. It's like we were saying in the beginning, these things just happen. You audition for something and they go, want to do this? And you go, okay, you're going to pay me? I'll do it. It was early on in my LA career that I auditioned for, I think it was Days of Our Lives.
Yeah.
And
Was this when they were doing like supernatural stuff in Days of Our Lives? Because I remember when I was a kid, there was an arc where there was like a demon possessing somebody.
Around the same time. I'm not sure. I was part of the Salem slasher era. I don't know if that was before the demon or post-demon.
Yeah.
But it was with John DeLancey. He's been in some of the Star Trek series. Mm-hmm. And I was to play opposite him, and I auditioned for that. And I was on the show for about 10 months.
Yeah.
And then I did a couple of other, or was Young and the Restless right after that. It was a couple of years later. I think I did my movies with Stuart Gordon, and then I auditioned for The Young and the Restless. And that was only supposed to be for 13 weeks. That's what you were contracted for. Every 13 weeks, they reevaluated your character and they wanted to see if they wanted to keep you. So they would hire you for a year. They would give you a contract for a year, but every 13 weeks they had an option on you. And they just kept renewing my option on The Young and the Restless. And I actually play the crazy character on that show. She was a borderline personality with psychosis. It was super fun. And every option period, they kept re-upping my option until 6 years later, I went, I've been on this show for 6 years. So it was great because it was good money and it kept me employed, you know, and as a performer, you're basically unemployed most of the time unless you get a series. And so I had regular work for 6 years so that I was able to put money in the bank and buy a house. And, you know, that was nice to have that cushion for a while.
Have you seen the footage of the soap operas that were filming love scenes at the start of quarantine where they were like kissing mannequins? Have you seen any of these? I've heard about that. I read about mannequin stand-ins.
Did you see it?
I've seen clips. Yeah, it's pretty great.
Really?
Yeah.
I have to look that up now that we're chatting about it. But I read about it, but then I didn't see it. I didn't look for it.
Now, did you ever go to any, because those are two kind of interesting fandoms and worlds of like soap operas and the horror community. Did you ever go to any like soap opera conventions or anything?
Yeah, I went on a cruise once for a soap opera. That was pretty fun. And I got to bring my mom with me.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Are the fandoms similar? I'm assuming they're all lovely.
They're pretty rabid fans, I'll have to say, in both. But I think the Yeah, and they're both very loyal.
Yeah.
I think that the fan base for horror movies is a little bigger and wider now.
Okay.
When I first started out doing soap operas, 50 million people a week used to watch them. Mm. Now it's like 5 million a week. So there's just so much product out there. Gaming has become a really big industry now. Games make more money than anything. And television is really big now. And there's so much product out there. There's, you know, I mean, everybody gets a smaller piece of the pie. And that's true in independent filmmaking. The margins have shrunk. You just don't make as much money as you used to with anything.
Uh-huh. And what are you working on nowadays?
Well, thank you for asking. it's funny. I've been pretty busy in quarantine, which is really weird. And speaking about gaming, I'm doing a pretty big game for a really big company. And I've never done a game before, and these guys know me from my horror movie roots, and it's kind of a horror game. So they just called me and said, would you like to do this? And I said, okay.
Yeah.
And so I've gone in, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 times and recorded for 4 hours each session, and I have something like 800 lines, and I have this really cool character, and she's
awesome.
Mom, and she fights bad people, and
that's great. So,
yes, I thought that's been really fun, and that'll be announced like next year sometime. But the really big thing I did is I was working on developing this movie called Jacob's Wife for about 4 or 5 years, and I'm a producer and actor in it, and that'll be coming out next year as well. It's about an older married couple.
Oh, that's great.
Exciting things happen to
them. Yeah. Now,
it's not like a scenes from a marriage type movie, or is it?
No, it's like a marriage story with horror elements.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, now that you're producing and acting, do you like being able to do both at the same time, or I don't know, I feel like that lets you kind of pick your projects a little more.
Yeah, and not every project that I want to produce in the future has me as an actor in it. I have a meeting tomorrow with these guys that we've been talking. I'm working with the company that produced Jacob's Wife, AMP Films, and a film came to me that somebody said, you should read this, it's really good, and there's no part for me in it. And I said, oh my God, we have to do this. I love the script. So we're meeting with them tomorrow. But I will say that, you know, again, talking about Your Next, when I did that film and I saw all those people doing all the different jobs, you know, you're an actor, you're a cinematographer, you're a writer, you're a producer. I said, well, why can't I do that? Is it, you know, is it too late for me? I hope it's not too late, because look, they're having fun, you know, they're doing it all, and everybody's making their own content. Why don't I try to do that? So that's what I've been doing. And yeah, I'm making some stuff for myself, but I'm just interested in a good story.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm excited to see that movie.
Yeah. And I'm also, thank you. And I'm also really excited because I'm going to be in the new season of Creepshow. So I was telling you guys, we had a little party. and I flew to Atlanta a few months ago and I did an episode of that. And, you know, I grew up with those movies and I mean, I've seen them all and, you know, I just was like, wow, that it was an honor to be part of that show. And I have a great character.
Yeah. We're big fans of anthology horror stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Creepshow, Tales from the Crypt, etc.
Yeah, right.
A buddy of mine did one of the segments of ABCs of Death Part 2, I think.
Who's that?
Steve Kostansky.
I know of him. Yes.
Yeah, he put me in his movie this year, and that was like the coolest thing in the world. A movie called Psycho Gore Man.
I was gonna say that's him. That's his movie. I haven't seen that yet. But everybody loves that movie.
Yeah, it's super fun. And I managed to get another plug in for him on the podcast.
I mean, you're still not Elliot Sharko and Hippo levels, but you're doing pretty well.
Oh, Sharko and Hippo, my new picture book that's in stores now with illustrations by Andrea Tsurumi. Yeah, Sharko and Hippo, sure. Everyone can buy that for the child in their life. Definitely.
Get something going on.
Dan, you need something to plug. Right now, your cat is just the only thing that you can plug right now. So how's Archie doing these days?
Oh, great. You know, he's got a little bow tie. He's fantastic. That's how you can know he's a wealthy cat, because he wears a bow tie around.
I mean, I can't even tie a bow tie, so I'm assuming he's much better off than me.
He must be very dapper if he's wearing his bow tie indoors. Yeah. That would be a party or something.
Yeah, just around the house.
Well, it's like Archie, Dan's cat, knows that it's not just about how he looks, but how he feels. And he just feels fancier with that bow tie on. Yeah.
I understand that. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this was super fun.
Comments, guys. Yeah, I really enjoy your show. I'm honored to be on it. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, this was a real pleasure.
Thank you for letting me pick a new movie.
Oh, no, no,
by all means, thank you for picking a good one
for us.
Okay.
I don't want to embarrass Stuart, but he was at a very high excitement level for the past few weeks while we talked about this, and we all were too. Stuart's such a laconic, kind of cool guy that I just needed to mention, especially how excited he is inside, but you can't tell. Yeah.
Oh, thanks, you guys. I'm really touched by that. I mean that. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Oh man, that was such a blast. I'd love to thank Barbara Crampton for taking some time and getting to chat with us. We're all huge fans, and she was a delight. So much fun.
She lived entirely up to her reputation as a delightful, wonderful person.
So thank you for listening. I'd like to once again plug my bars. If you're living in Brooklyn, we're doing takeout service and limited seating at Hinterlands and Minis. Hopefully things will change in the next couple months. And if you haven't yet and you're interested, we are still selling merch at hinterlandsbarmerch@gmail.com. Just email me and I will send you all the info. And then I will pack it up and ship it myself. I'm a little backed up right now because everybody's been so generous, but it's super great and it's helping us keep the lights on. I'd also like to recommend my wife's brand new podcast. First episode went up last week. I Know the Owner, which is bar people talking bar stuff. The first episode is the two of us talking about our bar in our bar with actual bar sounds around us. And it's a show that I'm very proud of. And if you are looking to kind of learn a little bit about the bar industry and also just spend some time with some bar people, I'd check it out wherever you listen to podcasts.
Probably in your ears, right?
In your ears is where you should find it.
Yeah, yep. Although, I mean, if you put it tight enough to the bones of your jaw, you can get those vibrations into your skull. Although, they still go through your ears, I assume, at some point.
They resonate, though. That's what you're saying.
Stuart mentioned he's backed up, and I'm worried it's because he's been trying to listen to podcasts in an area not his ears. Just don't even think about it.
Yeah, but I need the vibrations.
You know, we did this little bit at the end because we were like, oh, we need, you know, we should have a better ending, a more professional ending. And I think so
because
far
we're
nailing it.
We're not very
it.
Good at ending things.
We're nailing it right now.
We are totally. Yes, we are. Is that your way of saying that we should end the show, Dan?
Yeah, I was just trying to plug my little businesses and keep the lights on.
I mean,
this podcast is a...
I think I've been very supportive in those efforts,
Stu's just out there trying to achieve the American dream, Dan. Okay. But if you want to keep stomping on him like
a
Ruski Soviet,
I'm a real
monster.
The thing. I'm just hustling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to everyone for listening to the show. Thank you to Maximum Fun for being our network. Thank you to Jordan Cowling for editing and producing the show. Thanks
especially
again to
this
Crampton.
Episode, probably.
Yeah, if you like this nonsense, please rate us well on iTunes. It really does help. Or tell people. Podcasts are one of the things in this world that still mostly operates on word of mouth. So let's keep it that way. Let's keep the train rolling.
I mean, let's keep the word of mouth going, but we don't want to keep it that way. We want a big advertising budget, right? Like, I want to see a billboard with our faces on it that's like, bad movies, they've got your prescription. We're dressed as doctors, too.
I mean, if we can get it, sure.
There's a couple of, like, bandito, like Wild West criminals that are bad movies sitting at a table playing cards.
Oh,
and that we're standing in the doorway dressed up as Wild West lawmen, okay?
Uh-huh.
And we're like, wait, Dan, come on.
What's the tagline? Come on,
yeah,
Dan.
You're
a writer.
The tagline?
Bad movies are the disease and we're the cure. No one's ever done that one, right?
Never, ever. It's
also,
never been
it's
done.
Confusing because we're in the Wild West and diseases were
yeah,
a real
maybe we
problem
should be wearing
then.
The doctor stuff again. That would be better for the other billboard where we're dressed as doctors.
We shouldn't have employed Mixed Up Advertisers Incorporated.
Yeah, yeah. It's that one episode of Mad Men where Don Draper got drunk and messed up his presentation.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, anyway, we hope you've enjoyed this slightly different episode of The Flophouse. But until next time, I've been Dan McCoy.
I've been Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin saying thank you again, Barbara Crampton. You're great.
Bye.
Excellent. What if we just did that to prank our guests?
We have this huge collection of people saying four. We're like, someday we'll find a use for this
someday.
Thing.
Someday. It'll be an art installation.
Our big four project.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.